It's 16 and a half minutes past nine, and time now for Night Waves. Tonight, the historian David Starkey is in extended conversation with Philip Dodd.
Much of his life has been shadowed by a revolutionary King of England, Henry VIII. His early life was spent in Kendal, in a working-class Quaker family, into which he was born in 1945. In between, he has been a Cambridge scholarship boy, an academic historian, a gay activist, the rudest man in Britain, at least according to some in the media, and now he's a celebrated writer, as well as popular broadcaster, on subjects such as Elizabeth I and the monarchy. My guest in extended conversation this evening is the historian of Tudor England, David Starkey. He was a student of that great Tudor historian Geoffrey Elton, with whom he finally broke, and it's a characteristic of David Starkey that he seems to live in the shadow of family and patrons and then move beyond them, whether it is Elton and Cambridge or Radio 4's The Moral Maze. In that willingness to rupture relationships, if nothing else, he may be like the subject of his new book, his enduring passion, Henry VIII, the king whose break with Rome helped to form a new England and new forms of Englishness. His new biographical study, Henry, takes its subject only up until the age of 19. A second volume will show how the prince became the ruthless king with six wives. When we met, I asked him when he first recognised the importance to him of Henry VIII.
It was October 1964. I'd just gone up to Cambridge. It was my second undergraduate essay. And in that essay, I had a glimmering, an inkling of everything that I've done subsequently.
And what was it? What was the inkling?
The inkling was that the way history was approached was wrong. It seemed to me that the sort of history that I was taught, which focused on administration, on a word that I never discovered an undergraduate could ever spell, namely bureaucracy, was a history that was a sort of perversion of Max Weber. It was a translation into bad English of obscure German sociology. Got it wrong.
OK, now that's what I might call the historiographical explanation. I'm also interested just in the subject matter. Here you are, a bumptious 19-year-old. What is it about this period? Because, you know, historians, and you're one of them, have this habit of settling on something. And obviously it must have spoke to something in you, the subject matter.
The Tudors, it's no accident that they are always such big box office, that they occupy this central position in the national psyche, that even if you go to a deeply serious building like the Palace of Westminster, the heart of the building, the Prince's Chamber, is a monument to the House of Tudor. They're fixed there in our psychology. And they are, I think, for two reasons. There's again, to use that word, a historiographical reason, which is that the reign of Henry VIII is the axis round which English history turns. It's perhaps because he's so fat, he makes a very good axis, you know, all that grease and turning. But England is one thing before Henry. It's a quite different thing afterwards. So the period is of genuine central importance in every conceivable way. Linguistically, artistically, musically, every way. It's also, of course, that it's mythic. These people are both real and are myths. They operate at the level of myths. In fact, I would argue that the Tudors are the English Greek myths. Henry VIII is a better than Bluebeard. More horrible than Bluebeard, because realer than Bluebeard. And there's not a question, you know, in the Bartok opera, of mysterious doors opening into rooms that we don't know about and nameless horrors. We know exactly who is in that room.
And do you think that's
the horror is not nameless.
And do you think that's partly why, in a sense, Henry VIII has been recycled in cinema?
Constantly, absolutely. And also, again, those are both rather grand statements, historiography, myth. Let's come down to the slightly rough and dirty. The Tudors are brilliant soap opera. I mean, imagine, Philip, we go along, you know, we like each other, we trot along together, being on that nice margin of the intellectual and the vulgar world of commerce. We go along to a television producer, we say, I've got this great idea, you know. We've got this man who begins as this incredibly handsome boy, then he turns into this great fat tyrant. And do you know, he marries six times. What is a producer going to say? Oh, come on, you two. This is far-fetched. Oh, by the way, and he, you know, cuts the heads off two of his wives. Come on, this is far-fetched. This is absurd. And it's precisely that it has that extravagant, genuine extravagance of soap opera.
The way you speak, in a sense of the myth of the Tudors, this is actually England and Englishness that's being invented and being reinvented. I want to take us back to the book. You say of Henry, the king who invented England. Now, William Caxton, Edmund Spenser, Cranmer, even Luther's demand that, as it were, you know, the Bible be in the vernacular. The king who invented England sounds to me a wonderful phrase, but I don't really believe it.
You've got to ask yourself whether all those nice intellectuals would have had any impact at all if it hadn't have been for Henry. This is the key issue. And it seems to me that they wouldn't have done. Remember, this is not an age that tolerates intellectual dissent. Cranmer, we all know, was burned, but after he'd done a great deal and done a great deal of damage. If, in fact, Henry had not wanted his divorce, had not wanted to get rid of Catherine and to marry Anne Boleyn, Cranmer would have been an obscure Cambridge don. He would have not gone anywhere.
The king who invented England suggests that, as it were, kings are not invented by history at the same time as they invent history. This is like England is an epiphenomenon of a king's reign. You don't really believe that.
I do. I believe that the England that we have now is that. The tendency is, of course, to see the crucial age for the invention of England as Elizabeth. To look at the cluster, you mentioned one of them, Spenser, Shakespeare, so on. In fact, the key changes happen under Henry. What we need to understand is...
I understand that, David, but why do they happen? You're telling me they happen because of
Henry.
They
happen accidentally. They happen accidentally.
So Henry did not invent England.
Oh, yes, he did. But sorry, what we've got to understand is that enormously important things like a change of national psyche, a change of national religion, a change of our relationships with the continent of Europe, a term which is incomprehensible before the reign of Henry VIII, all of this happens because of something small. We tend to think of history, big things requiring big causes. Very often they don't. With Henry, I can demonstrate that this is true. What happened in England was that because of the peculiar circumstances of the divorce, which normally would have gone through on the nod, popes were very understanding about the problems of kings, Henry's wish for divorce coincided with the triumph of Catherine's family in Italy, the capture of Rome, the capture of the Pope, and so on. And the result was you could only achieve it by a cataclysm. That cataclysm, as political cataclysms so often do, leads to a gigantic cultural change. English nationalism, I think, is invented in the crucible of the Reformation.
We agree with that, David. Yeah. I'm going to keep quoting it.
The Reformation would not have happened as it did without Henry's divorce.
No, no.
Look,
I'm quite happy for you to get aerated, heated. All right. What I'm interested in is the king who invented England. So, of course, he's important. But, you know, Tolstoy's War and Peace meditates for a long time on why Napoleon crossed the Rubicon. Mm-hmm. There are historiographical issues at stake here, and there's a flatness about the king who invented England that cancels any other agency, not only Cranmer and Spenser and, you know, I said Luther's heroic and appalling kind of acts at freeing the Bible from you know, the single universal language. It's that, I suppose, that I want, as you can see, I don't believe.
But I'm asking you to do something else. I'm not asking you to deny the importance of Cranmer or of Luther or of the very fact, for example, that the first collected edition of Chaucer is printed in 1532. It is result of direct royal policy. It is printed by the king's printer. The introduction to it is written by Gordon Brown. It's equivalent, can you imagine? Sir Brown Tuke, the treasurer of the chamber. And for the first time, this advances the claim of English as a great European language and Chaucer as a poet equivalent to the English Homer or the English Virgil. This is a consequence of Henry's Reformation. It's No, it's not. It's the king's reformation. It would not have happened as it did, as this extraordinary top-down process without Henry. And therefore, Henry is the primum mobile. Let's have another term. Henry is the prime cause.
No, it would not have happened without is not the same as saying he invented England.
I think actually that this is a quibble over words. I think that what I'm using that phrase to try to do is to focus attention on this. This is what matters. It's this extraordinary concentration and clustering of change in a single 10 years. It's not simply a revolution in poetry, which we've been talking about, which is not simply Chaucer, but the impact of a Chaucerian revival on contemporary English verse. Again, the key changes, blank verse, the sonnet, do not happen under Elizabeth. They happen in the 1530s. Similarly, there's a cartographic revolution. There is a conceptual revolution in the nature of England, brought about by the fact that for the first time, you have to conceive of England as being subject to a joint attack from continental Europe. So you have to reimagine it as an island. We think that the fact England is an island protected it from invasion. In fact, in the Middle Ages, it exposed it to invasion. 1066 is not the last invasion. Every change of regime in the Middle Ages is the result of continental invasion. It's Henry, by a new cartography, an astonishing process of mapping. Imagine a government able to map the entire coastline from Hull round to Milford Haven, to look at every port, every harbour, every headland, to measure it, to carry out precise trigonometrical measurements. But it is Henry, and that is...
It's the reinvention of a particular kind of science that contributes to it.
This is literally Henry. This is done on a large block of slate in Henry's workroom in the Palace of Whitehall. It's a unique phenomenon in European history at that point, that the revolution is harnessed so directly to a particular set of requirements, which I rest my case.
All right. England. What about Wales? There's hardly a reference to Wales. It's as if it isn't only that Henry is the founding myth of England, but actually, pardon me, says David, he's your founding myth.
I think that would undoubtedly be true. What Henry does, of course, is to incorporate not simply Wales into England, even more radically, he tries to incorporate Calais. The myth of English nationalism is from its very beginning imperialist. It's from its very beginning expansionist and imperialist. Even if one looks at the masterwork of the Arthurian imagination, which feeds not simply into Henry VIII's reign, the Morte d'Arthur, Malory, which of course feeds into Tennyson, that is a work which anglicises and localises. Arthur. There's a most wonderful shift as one reads the Morte d'Arthur, which I'm sure is one of the books Henry reads as a child, in which it begins as Camelot. And then, of course, he realises, well, actually, it's probably really the capital of Anglo-Saxon England. So Camelot then becomes Winchester. And by the time you've got to the end of the Morte d'Arthur, Camelot has become Westminster. It's become the actual capital. And even there are even more wonderful things in this. You know, Our Lady of Shalott becomes Guildford. And, you know, this ultimate bathos. The myth is, that, as I said, England, it seems to me, not accidentally, and again, it's true of the great English offshoot of America, there's a kind of natural expansionism about the thing.
Yeah. No, listen, I buy all that. The difference we have is, of course, I think it's reinvented throughout history and it's much more contested. But when we come back to Englishness...
Totally, it's totally contested.
OK, when we come back later to talk about Englishness now, let's come back to some of these things. But one of the interesting things, and I suppose to think more about you now, because, as I said, I think, in a sense... That's right. And Henry at that level is your founding myth too. You know, you speak a lot, and at that level you're a good Whig historian. I'm not going to allow you to pull your face when I say that, you know. But one of the things about you I've been thinking, of course, is you've cast yourself, and my view is you're a performer. Your persona in that sense has been the kind of rudest man in Britain, or whatever they said about you in the Morals. At that level, you've cast yourself as un-English.
I think that's true. I've cast myself as an outsider. I was an outsider. I was born to the bizarrest type of family. I was born a working-class Quaker. I was born in the north of England.
That's not bizarre.
It's very bizarre. There are very few working-class Quakers. One of the things that I think is important is the tradition of the margins of countries, the margins of religious belief, the margins of social classes. And I remember in the hall of my little grammar school, there were the boards, there were the honours boards of those who'd gone to Oxbridge. I can still remember standing or sitting there thinking, they're the ones who escaped. They're the ones who got away from this.
And you thought that at the time?
I thought that at the time as I sat wetter inside my Packamack than outside on some dreadful holiday runabout round the Lake District with pouring rain and not a trace of a daffodil or Wordsworth in sight, I thought, I want out. I want to go away.
And I suppose why? Because if I throw back the history at it, you know, there's an extraordinary radical history of Northern England, you know, that
Kendall was at the centre.
Absolutely, which is there in Henry's reign. It's there slightly later during the English Revolution.
Well, it was radical conservatism under Henry, of course. It was the reaction against the Reformation. It was the reaction against everything that he was doing. I found it, I suppose, unappealing in a very simple material sense. I wanted a world that wasn't poor. I was born poor. Not desperately poor, but poor enough. And I wanted a world in which you didn't have to worry about 2.5 pence at the end of the week, which my mother did. I wanted a world in which I wouldn't need to think of scrubbing other people's floors, which she did. I was very fortunate in that scholarship then was available to people like me. The system of the grammar school opened up an entire world to me.
I'm interested because that sense of you as wanting to escape and escape poverty, one is marked by it. I've been marked by it in a different kind of way. So I'm interested in how it marked you.
I hope it didn't make me chippy. This was the age of exaggerating the Northern accent, of generally enacting some kind of D.H. Lawrence angoisse. I never felt any need to do that.
And why?
Well, because nobody had ever stood in the way of my career. In fact, I would argue the opposite, that overwhelmingly I received encouragement, help and understanding. From the very moment in front of me here is my copy of the T.S. Eliot's The Four Quartets. It's dated December 1963. It's when I won my scholarship to Cambridge. The matching volume to it, which is Eliot's Complete Works, was given me by my primary school headmistress, Elsie Clyburn. And she was the first of an entire procession of people there, like the kings in Macbeth, who helped me.
I want to ask you, you know, you mentioned Lawrence, and if you go up to David Story, there are a lot of novelists who've gone your journey, who wanted to escape, who've written about it, who spent the rest of their life brooding on those they've left behind.
I was an only child. There was nobody to leave behind. Also,
there were your parents.
There were my parents, and I didn't leave them behind. Remember, again, it's peculiar because they were immigrants. They had not, I don't mean immigrants in the sense of extraterritorially, but they'd moved to Kendal from South Lancashire. Kendal is a right tight little town, and even if you come from only 5 miles away, you are known as an off-comer. So I felt absolutely no loyalty. I felt loyalty to my schools. I felt loyalty to my teachers. But to the community, very little. So I had no difficulty in casting dust off my feet. Now, relations with parents are obviously different and can be difficult.
Particularly difficult when you move across an educational
when you move across an education,
terrain where they cannot follow you or where they've not preceded you.
Where they have not preceded me, precisely. And my mother, having been the great force, you know, she is the first of those people pushing me and directing me and shaping me. She really, I think, aspired to be a Pygmalion. In fact, that line of people moulding and shaping me, so many of them did aspire to be Pygmalions with the terrible consequence of the word bloody being uttered, you know, and the thing falling apart. She, after all that enthusiasm, finally invoked that old working class phrase, educate your child and lose them. And I think there's no doubt she finally felt that had happened.
Educate and lose. I mean, did you talk about it?
Yes. I mean, not a huge amount. And at that point, my relations with my mother were also poisoned by the business of coming out as gay and whatever, which she never forgave and, as always, blamed herself, which made her blaming of me, you know, all the more agonizing for her. So we never discussed it very fully. But I think there's no doubt it is right. You move into a different world. Your values change. Style of living changes. Accent changes. Interestingly enough, the older I've got, I think the easier I found it to go back to that world. Because you become...
My Methodist teachers tell me repentance is unlike innocence. You can't go back.
Well, to spend some time in it. In other words, that I think when you make the first changes, you're aware of the fragility. I suppose, if somebody were wishing to satirise me, you're aware that suddenly your A may become short. As you get older, you've grown into your new skin. You remember the wonderful Rudyard Kipling about how the rhinoceros got wrinkles in his skin. Originally, rhinoceroses had buttons down the front and they could take their skins off when they went for a swim, until a wicked little monkey, I think it was, scattered breadcrumbs inside, and the poor rhinoceros sort of rolled and rolled and rolled and wriggled and wriggled and wriggled, and the buttons came off and his skin was wrinkled. Well, I think you become comfortable in your new skin, and that makes you more confident. In the same way, I think, that dear old Dr. Rude... Now, Dr. Rude was a very interesting figure. He was an invention...
This is your invention.
It's not. We're talking about the invention of England. Let's now talk about the invention of public personalities. The actual name itself was a Daily Mail headline. It was built on the venerable George Austen.
I was going
Austen.
To say it was George. Listen, I'm not interested in going back to that. But what I'm interested in is you have invented yourself. That's part of what constitutes journey from Kendall
but of course,
to now.
But of course, so what? Every human being is an invention. Either other people do it for you or you do it for yourself. If you've got a powerful character, you do it for yourself, and you take control of yourself. Of course,
so,
you do.
Okay, but why did you invent yourself in that particular way?
Well, until you interrupted me, I was trying to tell you. you're getting as bad as the Today programme. Obviously, there are aspects of me which are aggressive, are brazen. They were very much developed by the particular style of teaching which you get at Cambridge, the supervision, which is a form of interrogation. The way in which Dr. Rude was really fully invented was on the moral maze. And that programme was, of course, a brilliant example of what we've been talking about with the Tudors. That's to say, it was the use of personality to drive something else. The producer, David Coombs, was one of those Pygmalion figures in my life. He spotted that intellectual debate is at its most interesting, as we are doing now, when it's sharply personalised and characterised with different voices, different attitudes. And Coombs was one of those who turned the sort of rather vague me, occasionally capable of being rude and whatever, into the monstrous figure of the moral maze.
I know, but because...
in which I was trained to perform.
I was going to say, but then it's a very odd thing, because you're not Thersites in Troilus and Cressida, who was really rude, you know. You know, you're not, and also I'm surprised that you allowed yourself to be used like this. And let me give you an example. He's a different figure entirely, but, you know, I think it was Joyce said, I will not come to London and play jester to the court of the English. Now, part of me says, shame on you, Starkey, for allowing them to use you like that.
Why?
Because it was kind of niche marketing.
Well, it was niche marketing, but I was equally capable of moving on and discarding it. It paid staggeringly well. It opened the door.
So this is kind of teleological. Because it worked, it's okay. Because it could not have worked.
Indeed, it could have been disastrous. But isn't the truth of anything that whether it works or not? I'm sorry. I believe the only judgment of behaviour is result. And I mean, so far, I'm sure I can put a foot terribly wrong, and maybe I've done so in this programme. But I have been reasonably sure-footed in walking through the treacherous sands.
But what I want to do now, because we've had enough of the angry man, OK?
I'm just not angry.
No, but we've just seen him in action. What I want to do now is play something from a friend of yours, Matthew Paris, to actually give another side of you.
I suppose hundreds of thousands of people know David as an historian, and perhaps millions of people know him as his Daily Mail-style incarnation, Is This the Rudest Man in Britain? They know him for his studied rudeness. What far fewer people realise about him, I think, is that he's a fiercely principled man and something of a campaigner. I used to be parliamentary vice president of a group called the Conservative Group for Homosexual Equality. It's changed its name to Torch. And David Starkey carried the torch, and he carried that torch for many years, and at a time when it wasn't popular, it wasn't considered smart or progressive to be involved in gay politics or gay campaigning. He is a conservative, he's deeply conservative, but he's also a radical, and he's also something of an idealist, and those three things make an interesting, a slightly awkward combination.
As Matthew Paris, I knew as an awkward combination.
I did what I did, partly out of principle, he is right, but above all out of calculation. I had, after all, gone to London from Cambridge as a young man. In those days, I was not unattractive. I was determined that I was going to enjoy myself. But it struck me that there was one thing that I had to do, which was to protect myself. One of my great and hideous memories of childhood, this is long before I really knew I was gay, was Kendal had, as little towns always do, a gay scandal. And needless to say, it was the usual group of suspects. It was a schoolmaster. It was a vicar. It was a deputy manager of a bank. And the hideousness of the humiliation and the destruction of lives, and of course in those days, imprisonment, was it left an abiding impression on me. And I thought, that is not going to happen to me. And curiously enough, you see, the best way to protect yourself is by being honest, open, frank. The only people that the press destroys are those who've concealed something. If you're open, you are free and you are safe.
But you also know that not concealing involves other people who may want to make different decisions from you.
Like my mother. Yes, and she was a victim. She was a victim. People are damaged by it. Of course they are. But human behaviour involves damage. The notion that you can move in a world in which nobody gets hurt, this kind of, you know, ROSP view of human life in which it's possible to behave, says everybody's safe all of the time, is an absurdity. It can't be. I'm also an optimist, curiously. I believe that there is such a thing as human progress, that there is such a thing as human advance. But you know it comes because one generation breaks with a previous one. This is why the role of mentoring or parenting is both so enormously important but so brutal and fragile, because especially if the mentor, you know, has, like my mother did, had, like Geoffrey Elton did, had actually, as quite a few of the people that I've worked with in the media, that sense they've invented you, they've created you. Well, I'm not prepared for that.
But it sounds to me as though you are prepared for a time to collaborate with it, because you have to collaborate with the Pygmalion Galatea myth.
Of course you do. But what is the problem with that? These people have something to teach me. They all taught me. I could not be what I am without that. But it's rather like a Russian doll, you know, they're structures within structures within structures, but you break out of each one. But I mean, let's look at the last 10 years. I think rather successfully, Dr. Rood is giving way to one of Britain's best loved historians, you know.
Macmillan said, if you can live to your 70 in Britain, you become a national treasure. But there's another element of what Matthew said that's interesting, which is the Tory.
I'm not a Tory, I'm a Conservative. I am absolutely not a Tory.
Okay, so you're an Edmund Burke man. Edmund Burke, the great believer in an organic developing England.
I'm a bit of a Burke, but I'm a sort of John Stuart Mill liberal. Essentially, I believe in personal freedom and economic freedom. I had this wonderful family experience. My mother voted Liberal. My grandfather, who lived with us, was a Lancashire working class Tory. And my father was an active Labour Party member and, you know, regional general secretary for the AEU, the Amalgamated Engineering Union. So I had this wonderful diverse range of choices presented to me. And I voted every way in an election. I only became a Tory or a Conservative in a settled sense with Thatcher.
In 19- 1995, you wrote a piece for The Guardian called The Days of Empire, where you said, England is dead.
I think that's true as a conventional nation. In the same way that we went into European-style nationalism, that's to say blood, soil, language, religion, whatever, very early, we have come out of it very early. England has become a kind of, again in Radio 3 language, meta-nation. We've become a place of the mind. We are now rather like Rome. In other words, that it's a whole series of associations which are literary, which are historical, which are landscapes, real and imagined, which are houses, real and imagined. And that's what England is, and it bears only a passing relationship to Surbiton.
OK, but then, you know, one of the characteristics of England and Englishness, as people have been saying it's been dead, you can trace it back. Richard Hoggart says the real England was in the working class between the wars. Oh. No, Orwell says it was before the First World War, and so on. So part of me wonders about, you know, I'm worried about the England is dead, because there's a way in which you're watering a world that you now think is dead. Because after all, if you read the beginning of The Heart of Darkness of Conrad's book, England is like Rome. In other words,
I didn't know that.
It's like the Tiber. The Thames is like the Tiber.
Well, I think he's right.
You're now falling into the habit of the English to bemoan its passing, which suggests to me that you've got more problem with living now than you, as it were, your public persona will allow you to acknowledge.
I don't think so. I think, again, one of the very striking things from the beginning has been the very powerful element of nostalgia in being English. The very first English at the time of Bede had, at the same time as having destroyed Roman Britain, this extraordinary sense of nostalgia about these great monuments. I mean, the way in which the myth of Arthur works, and it seems to be a very powerful element of the English experience, even at the times when it's most aggressive and brazen and successful.
But if that's true, David, there is a way in which the danger of nostalgia is the English who write about these things are always uncomfortable with the England that is.
No, on the contrary, I think I rather enjoy. I am free floating. I am outside ordinary categories normally when I turn up.
Which itself is an ordinary category. Now everybody is a rebel. Well, in 1790, no one was a rebel, which is the reason Shelley and others were rebels. Actually, being
I'm
outside.
I'm not saying a rebel. So you're constantly putting these terms of violence in my mouth. They're not there, and I never use them. I don't see myself as being a rebel. What I'm trying to say is that I am perceived normally as being rather. Despite the maverick reputation as being, you know, I wear Savile Row suits, I normally dress very conventionally, I operate at civilised dinner tables, I live in a country house, but I, you know. None of that is me. None of that do I inherit. None of that is, if you like, natural. All of that is what you were talking about, is invented, assumed, consciously assumed. But as I've done it myself, I don't have agony. I am not tortured with guilt because working class people suffer. I was one and I got out of it. I have no sense of regret about the North. I was born there, but I chose to get out. And again, the world that I'm in now, I find utterly fascinating.
No, I understand
as to what
that.
Is happening. No, so
I understand that, David.
Where
but
are the
if England is dead, I mean, if you look back at English history, if you look at Shakespeare or Dickens, both of them worked in a very vulgar terrain called the commercial domain. In other words, I'm part
like
of
like me. You mean?
No. I wasn't thinking of
no,
you.
No,
for
no,
a
no.
Moment. I'm quite happy to think of you. But I suppose what I'm thinking is, when you think of the institutions that sustain culture, you go back to the state and you go back to universities. And for a particular, but actually rather small historical period, they were the agents and the nurturers of culture. But actually, they're not now, as they weren't in mid-19th century
England. Well, absolutely.
England,
you've preached to the converted. I agree completely. I would suggest that modern commerce is, in fact, moving against a notion of any serious culture in a very, very fast and radical sort of way. I think that, you know, the impact of celebrity culture, big brotherization and so on, is real and is damning. The great work that we should all be talking about, teaches us what we are becoming is Brave New World. It's not 1984. It's Brave New World. Brave New World is absolutely spot on about what commercial drug-ridden culture means and about the absolute incomprehensibility. I think within 50 years, most of Shakespeare will be utterly incomprehensible, not simply linguistically, but in terms of motive. And remember, at the end where the savage's body turns round, it's because he cannot operate in a world without love and honour. Where is the place for love and honour and romantic emotion now? It's gone.
I don't know, why? As the historian in me would say, what's the evidence for that?
Well, there's huge evidence that honour always used to mean, and the only way that it can be understood in Shakespeare, is the honour of a woman, is the honour of a wife, is the honour of a sister.
I know, but there's honour in Henry IV, Part 1.
Indeed, and there's a different sort of honour. But let's just look at those, because that's what the end of Brave New World is about. And nowadays, it is illegal to vindicate that honour, just as it was, and incomprehensible, and rapidly becoming incomprehensible, just as it is at the end of Brave New World.
Give me an example.
Well, the fact that once upon a time, if a man struck or killed a woman who was making love to his wife, he would be regarded as doing a meritorious deed. He's vindicating honour, that most fundamental aspect of ordinary conventional masculinity, which, of course, I've never belonged to, but I understand from the outside. What we have done in the name of feminism and the, as it were, feminization of masculinity is to reject, as far as we know, the whole of previous human experience.
No, what you're saying is particular kinds of masculinity now are under threat. But that is as it should be.
But is it? Is it? Think about it. Sorry, you're very quick to justify it. You yourself are steeped in it. You are one of the propagandizers of it.
Philip,
let me conclude. You interrupt too much. Think about what you're saying. What has happened is that the entire world on which the cultural and literary inheritance of the Western world rests is in the process, in a mere 50 years, of being rendered so culturally alien as to be incomprehensible. We are cutting our civilization off by its feet. I think that a world that can no longer understand Shakespeare is the world of Brave New World. Yeah. It is the world of infinite shallowness and superficiality.
And if it's true, if it comes to pass, and there's no evidence it will come to pass, you may be right. But
it's already happened.
What you're doing...
The popular press.
Read the popular press during Shakespeare's time and you'd have thought, as it were,
I wouldn't have thought that at all. Because
some of the hang, drawing and quarter things that were sent round in Shakespeare's time would not have given you a sense that down the road they were doing King Lear.
Oh, they would. The sense of violence, the sense of passion, the willingness to risk life. I mean, so many of those people who went to the scaffold did so, not all, but so many of them went to it out of a sense of burning belief. Still more, of course, those who were burned. Now, I'm not advocating either hanging, drawing and quartering or burning, but it's a world, we seem to me to be rapidly moving into a world in which any perceptible real sense of value, historically grounded, has gone.
Okay. Then, as I hear you, this is the way I see it, and I want you to tell me if this is true, which is, it seems to me, you're conflating a particular kind of masculinity which is passing away, and you used yourself the idea of feminism, with a particular kind of English identity. And if I think of King Lear, when Goneril says to the man, "I want Cordelia killed," the man replies, "If it's man's work, I'll do it." Mm-hmm. In other words, manhood, masculinity is a very complex thing. And if we are becoming more feminized, that may or may not be a good thing. But it certainly ain't the end of civilization. I want to play you something from one of your former students because it feeds into this conversation. And this is Anna Whitelock, who was one of your students and is now, as they say, in the same terrain as you historically.
He could certainly be a bit of a nightmare as a supervisor, but there's no doubt he's been hugely influential, and I have a great deal of respect and affection for him. I think it's probably fair to say that he does have a male-dominated view of history. His research didn't focus on the women at court, but he paved the way for others to do that. Obviously, he then went on to study Elizabeth and write her history, but she might be seen as a kind of iconic quasi-male figure, perhaps atypical for her time. I think Starkey always probably thought of me as a rather bolshy woman. And a recent comment he made on my forthcoming book on Mary Tudor was perhaps it could only have been done by a woman. Not sure how to take that.
It was very kindly meant. I think it only could have been done. And her style of comment, Anna's style of comment, was, of course, precisely that voice of new womanhood, which I have no problem with, and I've never had any difficulty of dealing with. I think, again, you've been kind in not going on too much about my homosexuality, my third sexery, if you like. But I do think if you're gay, you are able to conceive of gender roles, again, slightly from the outside. You're able, of course, to see, we were talking, again, remember when I was talking about masculinity, I was never part of that. I was a sissy. I hated rugby. I thought it was incomprehensible. I've never been able to understand how a man could go into battle and stand there and kill and be killed. But our culture has been founded. Sorry, it's not just that masculinity is a little aspect of it. The difference of gender roles has been absolutely central.
And what you're saying is that the loss of this, whether one regrets it or not, is the death of us.
Well, and I'm saying it's the death of one particular human phase. I mean, the only country that's avoiding it to an extent is America, because, of course, it has been still number one. And what really defines the peculiarity of English nationalism, why, for example, H.G. Wells is able to say the glory of being English is that we have no national dress, that's because we didn't need cultural nationalism, because we had something much better, which was a particular sort of political top man identity. And America, of course, has that. So a lot of these cultural wars have been sort of semi-concealed.
So at one level, it sounds to me now as if your nostalgia, a term you used earlier, is in a sense for that moment when England was number one.
No, I'm not. So I really... It's nostalgia in the sense of I suppose a kind of almost poetical emotion, that you can look at these phases in human experience. Remember, the whole point of being a historian, Philip, is that you are a tourist in time, like a tourist travelling abroad. The historian is somebody who has got his feet in two worlds. He is a kind of dragoman, an interpreter between them. What I have tried to do is, again, to look at this invention of England, this explosion of ideas and culture under Henry, and to try to root it in just the horror of what was going on, but at the same time, this extraordinary, extravagant personality of the man.
I want, as if we can now, as we come to the end, I want to play you something of the historian, and I want you, in a kind of child's game, to recognise it for me.
This is a history of everyday things in England, from the time of the Norman Conquest in 1066 down to the end of the 18th century, and it has been written for boys and girls of public school age. It is an account of the work of the people, rather than of the politics which guided them.
That is the introduction to the Quinnell's History of Everyday Things in England. I still have the copy, signed, as a school prize. This tells you my kind of primary school it was. That book is about things. It was given to me by Elsie Clyburn as my headmistress. That is probably the most influential single thing that I have ever read. It's a quite wonderful book. It deals with things that were utterly unknown, still are largely unknown in academic history. Dress, chairs, cooking utensils, eating habits, toilet habits. And what it does, it acts as the most powerful counterbalance to the outrageous dominance of words in academic history, this terrible diarrhea of language. And what it helps you to do is to do what the good historian should, which is to envisage a whole world. The French phrase, histoire totale. And what I've tried to do in my history, Philip, is try to put these people into a complete world.
David Starkey, thank you very much.
Night Waves was presented by Philip Dodd and produced by Allegra McElroy. David Starkey's new novel, Henry Virtuous Prince, is published by Harper Press.